What our current mercurial trade policy, I think, has meant for Montana is that there are a lot of businesses that are suffering because the rules of the game keep changing. And it's very, very difficult to execute a business strategy under those circumstances.
This is Can Do, Lessons from Savvy Montana Entrepreneurs, a podcast that explores why Montana leads the nation in entrepreneurship and business startups. I'm Arnie Sherman. The structure of U.S. trade policy is so complex, even industry experts have trouble explaining it. When the U.S.-China trade war began in 2018, American taxpayers found themselves funding $28 billion in subsidies to farmers to compensate for failed trade agreements. Still, those subsidies aren't fully offsetting the losses to Montana wheat farmers from tariffs imposed by China, the largest export market for U.S. agricultural products in general. Joining me today are three guests. Brigida Freer is the executive director of the Montana World Trade Center. Robert Tino Sonora is a researcher with the Montana Bureau of Business and Economic Research. And Michelle Erickson-Jones is a fourth-generation farmer from Broadview, Montana, and a spokesperson for Farmers for Free Trade. Today on Can Do, Lessons from Savvy Montana Entrepreneurs, we're delving into tariffs, trade, and farm policy. How is the current situation affecting Montana imports and exports? And more importantly, what is the effect on the daily life of average Montanans? Production support for Can Do comes from the Dennis and Phyllis Washington Foundation, dedicated to investing in people to improve the quality of their lives. And from the Greater Montana Foundation, encouraging communication on issues, trends, and values of importance to Montanans. And from Blackfoot, providing communication solutions for Montana businesses, plus opportunities like C2M Beta, an innovation lab aimed at helping startups thrive. C2MBeta.com. Welcome, Brigida, Tino, and by telephony from Yellowstone Public Radio in Billings, Montana, Michelle. It's good to have you all on the show, and obviously this is a timely, important conversation to have, so thank you for joining me.
Sure.
Thanks for inviting us.
Thanks for having me.
About 27% of the U.S. economy is relying on trade. So what are trade agreements and what role do they play in influencing trade? Brigida?
Yeah, well, very simply, they're the rules of the game. You know, they're the frameworks that encompass those mutually agreeable parameters of trade between nations. But since we're on the radio here, maybe let me give that a bit of color. You know, imagine that you're at family game night, but instead of pulling out that little pamphlet of the rules for your favorite board game, imagine instead that you're pulling out and referencing thousands and thousands of pages dealing with everything from soup to nuts, literally, and that your livelihood depends on them. I mean, these agreements are comprehensive. They're years in the making and deal with everything from tariffs and non-tariff trade barriers to investment frameworks, conditions for workers, and much more.
We have 14 trade agreements with 20 countries. How do we trade with the other 175 or so countries?
A lot of it's unilateral, so that is country to country. We have agreements with them. I mean, we do have a number of trade agreements with sets of countries. So, of course, the most famous here right now is going to be the passage of the USMCA, which is the United States-Canada-Mexico trade agreement, which is basically NAFTA 2.0, NAFTA being the North American Free Trade Agreement. And so that's basically trying to set a free trade area for three countries. So that would be sort of an example of multilateral trade agreement. A unilateral would be something like which we just signed with Japan, where you just have a Japan to United States trade agreement. And so a lot of our trade agreements are with unilateral between countries. But we also have different types of trade agreements depending on the type of country. So we might have a trade agreement specifically or a set of rules for developing countries versus our developed countries. Sometimes we have things called most favored nation status, giving relatively favorable trade to countries which we sign these types of treaties with. And we can also use trade agreements to punish countries for not doing what we think or anybody thinks is right. For example, with Iran and Iraq, sanctions and what have you.
Michelle, how much of Montana's agricultural sector is involved in international trade? And also, how savvy are Montana farmers on all the rules and regulations about this work?
Montana's hugely dependent on trade. I don't know what the overall number is for the entire agricultural industry off the top of my head, but for various commodities, like wheat, for example, nearly 80% of our wheat is exported. So it's a huge deal. Roughly the same number amount of our barley is exported, same with our pulse crops. So we're heavily dependent on trade, international trade, especially to the Pacific Rim. I think farmers are certainly well aware of the impact of trade and how important it is to our state specifically. The necessarily inner workings, very wonky trade rules, a little bit less so. It took me a pretty significant crash course to learn what I've learned in the last couple of years. But I think we're very cognizant of how important it is to our industry and some of the impacts that we see based on various rules and regulations, be it through trade agreements or through the WTO.
You're a spokesperson, Michelle, for Farmers for Free Trade. Can you explain to our listeners what free trade is and what's the difference between free trade and fair trade, if there is a difference?
You know, for me, there's not really much of a difference between free trade and fair trade, because it kind of depends on what you're asking. If you're looking for, you know, the trade imbalance, whether or not we have a trade surplus or a trade deficit, I think that's what a lot of people mean for fair trade. And I kind of side with the half of the economists in the world that say that that's not really a significant issue. Agriculture in and of itself tends to have a trade surplus. We export more than we import. Now, free trade is really important to agriculture. We want to lower tariff barriers. We want more market access around the world. And we want other countries to follow the rules of the WTO or our trade agreements to ensure that we have equal access and fair access into those countries. For example, in the new USMCA, we have had issues with our wheat going into Canada that it was graded as feed, even though it was not feed grade wheat. It was perfectly good for human consumption, but they would grade it as feed. It was kind of a leftover problem from when the Canada had what was called the Canadian Wheat Board, and they did all their marketing for Canada. And that kind of has just been a lingering issue for years. And we have tried to fix it through quote unquote normal trade channels. We worked through our Congress with our congressmen, through our agencies. We tried to get it fixed in Canada through legislation, and we couldn't get it passed in Ottawa. And it's just become an increasing trade irritant, because on our side, we have changed the laws to allow heavier Canadian trucks to reach elevator points along northern Montana. And so those producers would sit up there with Canadian trucks knowing that they couldn't go to Canada if the economic conditions warranted, that it just wasn't treated fairly. And that those type of trade issues, you know, are blatantly unfair. It's insane that there's a difference in grading between our two countries. And thankfully, USMCA fixed that. We still have some work to do on a related issue with that. But it's those sort of things that are barriers to free trade.
Tito?
Yeah, I was just going to add, too. I mean, there's other types of trade issues that are trade imperfections, as economists call them. Right now, we're concentrating on things like tariffs and other types of non-tariff barriers, which Michelle just explained was this sort of ranking of different types of wheat would be a non-tariff barrier. But other countries and the United States as well, corn is the sort of classic examples where we subsidize a lot of our agriculture or other types of goods, which is another form of trade barrier, if you will, because it lowers the cost of production for a lot of for producers and makes our exports relatively inexpensive on for other countries to import.
Yeah, that has been actually one of our substantial issues with China. And that is a case we took to the WTO. The case was initiated in the Obama administration. The Trump administration carried it forward and we won it. And it is for China's domestic price supports. They subsidize their wheat at, they basically, if the farmer cannot sell it for a set amount per bushel, which right now I think it's around $8.50, then the Chinese government will buy it. It has forced the Chinese government to hold over 50% of the world wheat stocks. It has given Chinese farmers a signal to raise more wheat than the market itself would have signaled them to do. And so it's caused some significant issues. And China is the number one offender of that. India is also guilty of it as well. And it causes a lot of problems and costs U.S. producers a lot of money when that happens.
Brigida?
Yes, on the fair trade front, clearly trade agreements are documents that are to stand for very long periods of time. So unfortunately, they're not particularly agile. So it's good when they are course corrected, as we did with USMCA, and Michelle was talking about the treatment of U.S.-based wheat going into Canada. I wanted to just say that on the fair trade point, which is brought up repeatedly in kind of heated political debates lately, I just think it's very counterproductive to look at something like the balance of trade that may exist between one nation and another nation and say categorically without digging deeper, oh, because this country has a trade surplus with us, therefore the rules of the game aren't fair and we are losing as a nation. I just fundamentally don't think that that's true. Just as an example, if the United States exports about $5 billion a year to Ecuador, but we're importing about $7 billion a year, are we losing? Or does it just mean we're getting as many bananas as we'd like at a good price, right?
Tino?
Well, I mean, in a lot of this trade argument and this discussion is based on actual movements of goods and services, but the flip side of the same coin is movements of financial assets. So to finance our trade deficits, we end up importing, if you will, financial capital. A big thing was going on in the 1990s when the Japanese were investing a lot of plants, which actually helped the United States economy, building plants in Tennessee, or the Germans were built the BMW plant. Honda has a plant in Marysville, Ohio. So this is all investment that actually happens on American soil coming in from foreign countries, and that's actually increasing the capital of the United States, which actually has a benefit to our economy. And so, yeah, we might buy cars from Japan and import them, but on the other hand, they're using that money and then coming back and investing in the United States.
Yeah, when a country sells a lot of products to the United States, it allows that country to amass U.S. dollars, and then in many cases, that money is often reinvested right back here, whether that's, you know, real estate or buying T-bills. Yeah.
Right. And our bond yields are exactly, they're still very, very low. The United States, a lot of money is pouring in the United States, keeping our interest rates low, making interest. We could go on for days about this, but that's the idea, is we kind of lose that part of the discussion as well.
We actually sit on that a lot in the in Montana. That is an unrealized example of that. Most of our elevator capacity is owned by the Japanese. And they have done a substantial amount of investment into improving the capacity, making those facilities more efficient, and flat out opening new ones throughout Montana over the last 20 years. And so that's a really good example of, they are our number one wheat customer, but they're also investing a huge amount of capital in Montana.
Focusing on Montana here for a moment, Tino and Brigida have co-authored an article for the Montana Business Quarterly entitled "The Trade War Comes to Montana." What did you find out?
What our current mercurial trade policy, I think, has meant for Montana is that there are a lot of businesses that are suffering because the rules of the game, and I keep using that illustration, keep changing, and they change by the tweet. And it's very, very difficult to execute a business strategy under those circumstances. And, you know, whether we're talking about steel and aluminum tariffs, or tariffs that are on glass bottles that are being imported and used by our distilled spirits producers around the states, or tariffs on fabric for waiters, or glucosamine or chondroitin or other inputs, businesses around the state are suffering because their pricing on their inputs is increasing, and they are faced with a choice. It's actually not much of a choice. They're having to pass along those costs and their finished product to their customers. So what we're seeing is this waterfall effect where, and I'm sure we'll get into this, we've got tariffs that are being imposed. Those U.S. importers are paying more. They are passing those costs along. And so whether we're talking industry or retail, I mean, the effects are felt across the state of Montana. And I don't think that there is an industry that has escaped.
Tino?
Yeah, and it's policy uncertainty is the big deal. I think the tariffs, you know, I think if people could sort of look forward and say, okay, we're going to have a 25% tariff on steel imports or aluminum imports or whatever, then, and we knew that for sure, then they could sort of adjust for that. But it is the policy uncertainty. And in manufacturing, I was talking to somebody from Commerce the other day, and they were saying that's the main thing that they're hearing from the manufacturing industry. In terms of imports and exports in Montana, the data is just not readily available yet. It's on aggregate. Now, again, we might have...
It's anecdotal.
It's anecdotal. The data is very tricky to sort of plow through. You know, a lot of our agricultural output in that's produced here in Montana ends up being exported from you know, Seattle. So Washington's exports look like they produce every single grain of wheat ever produced because it's all going through their port. So there's new attempts to try to figure out where the sort of port of origin is and identifying that. But with something like a car, like a Ford, it's easy to identify. But if I'm looking at a wheat, which should be theoretically the same regardless of where it's produced, it gets much more muddied, and then you have middlemen on top of middlemen, and then the exporter, and then, you know, so.
So, Arnie, I'm going to guess you'll kick this over to Michelle in a minute, but just to give you an example that wasn't in the article that Tino and I just authored, not to give it all away, Tino.
Please.
But just to give a recent example and how this is hitting every industry, and even the ones you may not think are getting hit. So at Montana World Trade Center, we offered a training on alcoholic beverage export, and we did a webinar on that this week. And one of our speakers is a craft distillery owner, and what she talked about was her experience. She's essentially getting hit from both sides, right? So she's getting hit on increased prices for the bottles that she's importing, in which she bottles her delicious distilled spirits. Also, she talked in great amount of detail about the work that she has done over the last several years to build and establish and get to the point where she could initiate product sales to an importer in China. And they're just about to consummate their first transaction when this trade war was initiated. And, you know, what she saw was tariffs on the other side getting jacked up, so retaliatory tariffs, that just made that a transaction that didn't make sense anymore. So effects are being felt everywhere in places that you would not even think are impacted.
Do trade policies that we are currently engaged in affect businesses by the size of the business? In other words, are larger businesses hurt more or smaller businesses?
There's two sides. First, it's also sector specific. So if one sector is not necessarily involved in the goods that are being tariffed, then they're relatively scot-free. But small businesses definitely do have a disadvantage in that most small businesses might just have a single good that they produce, whereas a larger business might have a portfolio of goods, so they can sort of risk share, if you will, across their different production. So they might have a car for import that they export, and then a car that they have for domestic consumption. And so they can sort of balance the two somewhat, that larger companies can raise capital and money and funding better so that they can sort of smooth out some of these downturns through issuing stocks or borrowing or whatever, much easier than a small firm.
And I was just going to add for context that there are about 1,600 exporting firms in Montana, and they're almost all small and medium-sized businesses.
Michelle, what's your take on all of this currently?
Yeah, just like the example just used for the distillery, we've definitely seen it on both sides. There's been, you know, substantial impacts onto the cost of steel, as well as it's just disrupted some of the supply chains in the manufacturing side on the equipment dealers. You know, there's really not anyone that hasn't been touched by it. And for us here in Montana, I mean, we went from building the Chinese wheat market, which had been a little bit erratic because of their domestic price supports, but from building the Chinese wheat market to losing it overnight. They had imported, I believe, 1.8 million metric tons out of the U.S. in 2017 to zero the next year.
And what effect has the subsidy had? Has it made up for any of this at all?
The market facilitation program?
Yes.
The second round this year was better, but it certainly doesn't make us whole by any stretch of the imagination. The year before's was not even close. We got 14 cents for every bushel, and our best guesstimates is that the trade war had cost us 75 cents a bushel. So certainly not close, and this year didn't cover it either. And it's also cost us, I mean, we had 50% of the Chinese market for market share. Now we are down to essentially zero. We are really encouraged by the language in the new phase one deal, because it requires them to implement their tariff rate quota system, which is how they're supposed to implement or import fairly. And it should give us back that market share, but we're still at a price disadvantage with those retaliatory tariffs on. I did the math. Australian wheat is the most expensive in the world because of their drought, because of their situation. I added a 25% tariff to our average price of our wheat, and it's net that becomes the most expensive in the world going into China. So we're still at a price disadvantage if China doesn't give their importers breaks on those tariffs.
Michelle, can you explain what a tariff rate quota system is?
Sure. A lot of countries, when they join the WTO, will agree to a tariff rate quota system. And that means that they're going to import X amount of volume of a certain commodity or certain something at a lower tariff rate. So in the case of China, they agreed to import 9.4 million metric tons of wheat at a 1% tariff rate. Outside that quota, the tariff goes to 65%. Now, that doesn't mean that a country is required to bring in that much that's done on market signals. But in the case of China, where they use well over 15 million metric tons, they should have been importing their entire tariff rate quota system. And their fill rate on that has been historically low, somewhere around 30%. And so we took them to the WTO for that, and we won that case. And so as a result of that case, and then we codified or didn't codify it, but we put it in the China phase one agreement that they are required to implement that with transparency and to make it fair to how they allocate it between their state-owned enterprises and their private companies. So that should at least take 9.4 million metric tons back off the world market and also give us opportunity for a lot of growth in the China market.
We are speaking about all things Montana trade-related with our expert guests, Brigida Freer, Tino Sonora, and Michelle Erickson-Jones. Production support for CanDo comes from the Dennis and Phyllis Washington Foundation, dedicated to investing in people to improve the quality of their lives, and from the Greater Montana Foundation, encouraging communication on issues, trends, and values of importance to Montanans, and from Blackfoot, providing communication solutions for Montana businesses, plus opportunities like C2M Beta, an innovation lab aimed at helping startups thrive. C2MBeta.com. Let me focus on tariffs a bit. It came up. The tariff increases as a result of this administration is more than $40 billion. Who pays for this?
Well, the research has shown that has gotten passed on to the consumer 100%. And there are several papers that have come out of the Federal Reserve, out of Yale, out of Berkeley, so that we the consumer ends up paying it. Now, we the individual consumer don't really feel it. You know, I mean, yeah, we might have unless
we do it in some areas.
In some areas, yep. Like washing machines and these kinds of things, but we don't buy them that frequently. But you know, if we think about something like an agricultural good, that might cost us 2 cents or something. So it doesn't affect us individually in a big way unless we're buying a big ticket item. But roughly, the guesstimate is roughly 100% of the tariff is being paid by American consumers. There's something that's less often discussed. When you put on a tariff, that actually causes your exchange rate to appreciate, your currency gets stronger. And so some of those tariffs can be offset by a stronger currency, meaning that I can buy more yuan with my dollar. And so even though there's a tariff on it, the relative price of the good actually falls. There's also been a little bit of evidence to suggest that Chinese exporters are reducing their prices before they get to the United States. And then when you tack on top of that the 25% tariff, that actually keeps the price almost the same. That's a paper that just came out, I think, you know, in December of last year. I just found it a couple of days ago. So it'd be interesting to see if how all of these things play out. Now, that's not necessarily going to affect the export side, but on the import side, these are the kinds of dynamics that, if you will, that are going on. And our dollar has, if you look at the data I was looking at just before we came in here, 2018 is when January was when all of these things got passed. And lo and behold, as economists know, when you impose some sort of trade friction on your imports, it causes your currency to appreciate. And you do see about a 5% appreciation of the dollar vis-a-vis our largest trading partners.
So in the media, we hear about our trade wars, trade war with China, trade war with other. What is a trade war?
A trade war is just as it sounds. A trade war is basically you get in a tit for tat type of tariff situation or other type of non-tariff barrier whereby a country imposes a tariff. Usually, and I should just say that a lot of times we add tariffs And they can be very politicized. I mean, so for example, we believe for whatever reason that we should protect the steel industry, or the Obama administration felt we should protect the tire industry. And, you know, the idea is that it allows our domestic producers to keep producing. And so with some protections to enable them to raise their competitiveness. So what a trade war is basically that a country that gets tariffed retaliates with a similar tariff, and then there's a sort of going back and forth. I think the most famous tariff war that ever existed was the banana tariff war of the 1990s. There was a 16-year tariff war between the EU and the United States, and it started with a non-tariff barrier, which put some sort of qualitative identifier or restriction on bananas. And what the Europeans were concerned with is that if you have excessive curvature of the fingers, and that's a quote from the tariff legislation, that is not a banana and should therefore be basically blocked. Other examples of these kinds of things are GMO types of you know, beef and such. But a tariff, and so this war lasted 16 years. We've had and I'm not sure when we even finished, we had a soft pulp wood tariff war with Canada for 15 years. And so these things can last a long, long time, and they're not easy to win. They can be very prolonged, and they can involve a lot of things that aren't part of the original war to begin with.
And again, you have to remember, when you lose those markets that you've worked so hard to develop, they may come back never, right? And I think that in particular, our agricultural producers are very well aware of this. And flirting with that kind of disaster is ill-advised.
Well, Michelle, you could comment on this, but when they're not buying wheat from the U.S., where are they buying it from?
Our top competitors in Australia and Canada, they've always bought it. In the case of China, they've always bought it from Australia just because of location. But Canada, since the tariffs went into effect in 2018, their imports to China have surged about 400%. And to a certain degree, you know, people will say, well, the agriculture supply chains will realign and, you know, someone's got to get their wheat from somewhere, so you'll add customers. And to a certain degree, that is true. But in times of oversupply, which we're basically at right now, that someone is the odd man out, which is the United States. And in other cases, like in soybeans, you can see areas in Brazil, they add basically the size of the state of Illinois every year in soybean acres. They now outpace us as the world's largest producer of soybeans. So you can permanently move those supply chains, and you can't get it back because they can just add so many more acres than we can. And for people that are older than myself, you know, the Russia grain embargo stands out in their mind as we made a policy decision and we lost our number one market, and by extension built the world's largest exporter of wheat in Russia. It took them 30 years, but they did it.
So trade wars sometimes lead to creating new competitors for ourselves as an unintended consequence.
Absolutely. And then, you know, taking this beyond ag and just thinking about global supply chains that exist and how those supply chains will change perhaps permanently as a result of trade wars that we may initiate. That's an important consideration. And, you know, if a business decides that they are going to change where they're getting their inputs from, it's, I assure you, a decision that they don't take lightly, right? And if they're going to do that, they're going to try to do that for a long-term solution and avoid any kind of headache like that in the future. And again, that's where we get back to this issue with this very mercurial trade policy. Businesses don't know when they should just cut bait and when they should just try to carry on and hope that these trade wars come to an end. And also from the U.S. manufacturer perspective, who's to say that if they do make a change, if they do say, okay, you know what, we're just going to move our manufacturing elsewhere, who's to say that the country if they don't move it to the U.S., which is by and large what's happening, they're not moving it to the United States, they're moving it to another Asian nation, who's to say that that nation isn't going to be the next nation that's targeted by administration as a bad actor, a bad guy, and we're going to implement tariffs. So, and then bringing it back to the U.S., that's a whole other discussion. It's great when that works, but it does not always work.
And you make an important point. It's not like switching a light switch on and off. If someone does a new deal for wheat with another country, they're booking cargo ships. They have long-term contracts. There are things that aren't easy to move, even if you want to, once you put a different course of action into place.
Mm-hmm. Right. You know, and then on top of that, you add exchange rate movements, and then, you know, suddenly the Canadian dollar gets relatively strong because now China's importing more. So there's all these moving parts. And I'd like to add another thing that we haven't discussed yet, and it's less important for agriculture but more important for manufacturing, and that's vertical integration, whereby the United States, for example, a Ford, you know, where is a Ford produced? Well, a part of the Ford's produced in Canada, part of the Ford's produced in South Korea, part of the Ford's produced in Japan, et cetera, et cetera. And then it's all assembled in Mexico. Well, we just let's slap a tariff on Mexico because of unfair trade agreements. Then, well, who are we punishing? Are we punishing Mexico? Well, maybe the value added, as we say, you know, is the percentage change in the value of the final car in Mexico is relatively small, but we're punishing, you know, now what are we actually putting the tariff on? Are we putting the tariff on the car? Are we putting it on the radio? Are we putting it on the transmission? Well, maybe if the transmission was produced in Detroit, well, then are we punishing the... So what we're also seeing, in addition to this sort of horizontal trade, we're also seeing a lot of vertical trade that's going on. And actually a lot of trade, the vast majority of trade is what we call, now I can't remember what we call it, is vertically integrated. It's intra-industry trade. And so an intra-firm trade, it's not, you know, Ford's for Mercedes, it's Ford for Ford.
We mentioned already that we have a new recently signed U.S.-Mexico-Canada agreement replacing NAFTA, which was first implemented in 1994. And as Brigida mentioned, you know, these trade agreements have to be tinkered with over time because, for example, in 1994, we didn't have any tech provisions in the original trade agreement. And now there are tech agreements or tech provisions in the new agreement. And I think that there's some greater dairy farmer access. Michelle, what's the effect of the new agreement for Montana?
For Montana, aside from the Canadian grade grading issue, which I talked about already, there definitely was some updated language on the agricultural side related to biotechnology, as well as sanitary, phytosanitary regulations. And so those were just things that needed to be cleaned up. As we've already talked about, because it was an old agreement, biotech didn't exist when we signed the first one. So those parts are nice to add. And then it just, you know, takes away the threat of us withdrawing from NAFTA, because obviously the president is not going to withdraw from his landmark agreement. And that is crucial for our barley industry. Mexico is our number one customer. There's a lot of barley that's malted here, taken down to Mexico, then brewed into beer, and then actually brought back north. Modelo is one of the our top customers for Montana barley. And then it's also, we send basically no wheat down there out of Montana, but Mexico in general is our number one wheat customer for the United States. So it's critical for our Southern Plain states to maintain their number one customer and so that we have an outlet for our wheat.
Michelle, while you're talking about this topic, why don't you tell us a little bit about what Farmers for Free Trade does in general?
So Farmers for Free Trade is a bipartisan organization. It was co-founded by Senator Max Baucus and the late Senator Dick Lugar. And we really started as an organization to highlight how important free trade is for agriculture. And we have done a huge motorcade for trade to advocate for USMCA. We met with all across the country producers and congressmen and just talked about how important trade is, and now we're transitioning into what we will do after, now that USMCA is passed. But we certainly just want to continue to highlight the importance of trade, to talk to not only producers and the grassroots, as well as bridge the gap between the grassroots and Washington.
What trade policy actions do you think need to be implemented to help Montana producers and manufacturers be more competitive in the global marketplace? If you could add some things, advocate for some things, what would they be?
Well, I would certainly love to see us rejoin the TPP, which is now the CPTPP. Obviously, we have a agreement with Japan that addresses agriculture, which was crucial for Montana. We would love to be able to have a trade agreement with the rest of the countries in that agreement, especially Vietnam, which has a growing middle class. We also very much so need to address to India. India has steep tariffs right now on our pulse crops, and that is crushing the pulse industry in Montana. There's certainly a long list of trade places we would like to pursue, and none of those are small orders, but it's definitely, you know, important to our industry.
What about in the non-agricultural area? Brigida?
I hope we can get back to a place as a country where we are just not viewing trade agreements as zero-sum games. Michelle talked about a couple different multilateral agreements, like TPP, that we chose not to engage in as a nation.
And that's the Trans-Pacific Partnership.
Partnership, exactly. And I think much to our detriment. And what we're seeing, you know, the elements of the USMCA were very similar to TPP parameters. We're just coming to the game late then and giving an opportunity for other suppliers and other countries in the world to serve those markets that we would like to serve and have a competitive advantage and establish those relationships, where we are harming ourselves by categorically dismissing the importance of multilateral agreements and mutually beneficial trade agreements.
I would say, you know, as an economist, economists love free trade. We want no trade barriers of any kind, whether that be a non-tariff barrier, tariffs, you know, quotas, subsidies, et cetera, because you do take advantage of comparative advantage. And I think Michelle touched on it. Part of that is removing the same types of price supports that other countries give their own producers. You know, one of the more infamous or famous ones, of course, is the Common Agricultural Policy in Europe. And they provide tremendous support for their farmers. And we provide tremendous support for our farmers as well, particularly corn. And I would keep harping back on corn, but corn got an enormous amount of subsidies. For economists, it's just, let's have free trade. Countries should trade according to their comparative advantage. I don't make soap because I'm relatively bad at making soap. So I should import soap from a soap producer, and I will sell them my economic services, whatever that means. But that's the essence of trade. I mean, no one produces everything that they consume. They trade for somebody. Now we use money to make the facilitate that trade, but that's essentially what we're doing. Same thing on the international stage.
Just picking up on something that Michelle talked about there in her comments, a change that I would like to see. She mentioned the WTO appellate body. And
that's the World Trade Organization's appellate body.
Right. I think we have maybe two judges on it now. I'm not sure, but we...
No, we don't. Their terms expired December 7th, I believe.
Right.
We're down to none. It's non-functional.
It's non-functional. There are no judges on that appellate body. So if we are looking for an arbitrator for the rules of fair trade, we have zero forum for that right now. We have no forum at all. And that is something of our own making, if I'm not mistaken, because I believe that the U.S. has refused to agree with or appoint judges to that. Michelle, does that sound right to you?
Yes, that's true. We've been blocking all appointments since the Trump administration took over.
Thank you all for educating our listeners on this important topic. If you want to learn more about trade and its effect on Montana, you can go to the CANDU website, and there's links to the articles that Tino and Brigida wrote and websites for each of our guest organization. Again, I enjoy visiting with you and glad you could be on the show.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I appreciate your listening to Can Do, Lessons from Savvy Montana Entrepreneurs, produced by Peter Hoag and Beth Ann Austin in association with Montana Public Radio. For comments, recommendations for future guests, or general information, please go to mtpr.org. There you can also find previous guests' contact information and content from all our shows. Join us next time when our guest will be another Montana entrepreneurial leader. Once again, I'm Arnie Sherman, wishing you peace and prosperity.